Dose of Leadership Podcast, episode 231.
Welcome to another episode of the Dose of Leadership Podcast, the show that brings you inspiring and educational interviews with today's most relevant and motivating leaders. Each episode is dedicated to highlight real-life leadership and influence experts who dedicate their lives to the pursuit of the truth, common sense, and courageous leadership. And now, here's your host, Richard Ryerson.
Hey, welcome. Richard Ryerson with Dose of Leadership. Thank you for tuning into the show. So happy you're here. As always, this is the show where we talk about leadership. We focus on leadership. We have conversations about leadership. We bring people on the show so it can help all of us in our leadership journey, because it is important for all of us. It's central to everything that we do. Everything literally rises and falls with leadership, and that's why it's so important. And hopefully this show is one of the many resources out there that you can use to help you along your leadership journey, because you hear me say it on every episode. There's somebody right now looking to you for influence and guidance. Doesn't matter what position, what title you have, somebody is looking to you right now. So think about how impactful you can be if you set about to be intentional about your influence. And to do that, it's about adding value to everybody you come in contact with, and that takes work. It's easy to understand, but it takes a tremendous amount of work. Trust me, it's something I have to think about every single day. Sometimes we fall up short, but we keep pressing on. We keep driving on because it's about adding value to other people's lives. Hey, a lot of exciting things happening here at Dose of Leadership. I got a brand new show coming out I'm excited to bring to you, Out of the Mud. I'm going to launch it September 8th. It's a show where we bring people on the show about something we all have in common. It's how we deal with adversity. It's something that all of us are going to have to deal with. We can't escape it. We all share it. Things are going to happen to us. We're going to be thrown in the mud. And so I'm always fascinated by that story of how people make that choice to pull themselves out of the mud. What happens to them when they pull themselves out of the mud? They become transformed, right? And what happens in that transformation? We're different. It shapes us. It's who we become. And when we look back at our lives, it's all those moments when we pulled ourselves, or we chose to pull ourselves out of the mud, is that shaped us who we actually are. We all have the potential to be the hero of a great story, but it's our choice, and that's what we're going to highlight in Out of the Mud. So check it out. You can go right now to outofthemud.tv. It's a .tv. Outofthemud.com was taken. I'll get that eventually when it gets big enough, but outofthemud.tv is where it is at. You can find the promo video there. You can sign up on the email mailing list to stay informed. So more things to come on that. All right. Oh, I'm so excited to have this next guest on my show. This was when I launched Dose of Leadership. Again, this was one of the bucket lists of individuals when I sat down on that December 17th in 2012 thinking about this show and who I'd want to talk to. And Darren Hardy was one of those individuals. If you haven't connected or looked up Darren Hardy's stuff, you need to do that today. Go to darrenhardy.com, and he's got a wealth of resources for leadership, for entrepreneurship. His book, The Compound Effect, was huge for me. I love his latest book, The Entrepreneur Roller Coaster. If you're an entrepreneur or not, there's great leadership tidbits in there. And if you are an entrepreneur, Darren Hardy has to be on your list. He is the visionary force behind Success Magazine. He is its publisher and founding editor. He's been a business leader in the success industry for over two decades. He's got this unique and kind of unfettered access to the most successful people on the planet. He's what I want to be doing. He's an inspiration for me. But he does it on steroids. I mean, he's talked to Richard Branson, Steve Jobs, Warren Buffett, Donald Trump, Howard Schultz, Charles Schwab, and the list goes on and on. And he does that because, just like on this show, he wanted to uncover the secrets to their success, and he reveals it and he shares it to us. That is the mission behind Success Magazine. Darren also was a mentor and coach to many of today's high-performing CEOs, advising many large corporations, and he sits on the board of several companies and nonprofits. He's a highly sought-after keynote speaker. Amazing to see. I would love to see him live. He's a media contributor and the New York Times bestselling author of, as I mentioned, The Compound Effect and Living Your Best Year Ever, and The Entrepreneur Roller Coaster, which you have to read. You just have to read it. He's got a brand new landing page out there. He's launching here in a few weeks or soon, a progressive white paper and video series to uncover the 8 tragic mistakes most entrepreneurs make and how you can avoid them. And you can get that and go there at 8tragicmistakes.com. I highly recommend that you check that out. Anyway, without further ado, you're really going to love this conversation. He's a great conversationalist, great tidbits, great content in this interview. It's one of my favorites. So without further ado, here's Darren Hardy from Success on Dose of Leadership. Well, Darren, what an honor to have you on the show. Welcome to Dose of Leadership.
Richard, pleasure to be with you and your audience.
I got to tell you right out of the gate, I love entrepreneur roller coaster. It comes to me personally at a perfect time. You know, I've been on this journey with this show, and I still have a golden handcuff as a professional pilot at a company here in town. But pursuing this entrepreneur dream has been, personally for me, sometimes lonely and sometimes kind of scary. And your book, Entrepreneur Rollercoaster, is coming at a good time. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of it.
Well, for the reasons that you just stated, most people see people on the cover of Success Magazine or Forbes or Fortune or Bloomberg's icon shows, and they see all these fantastic success stories, and they desire to be that, you know, great success and to maybe venture off into entrepreneurship. But what they don't realize is what they're really walking into. It is definitely one of the most scary, frightening. You have to stare at your self-identity and self-image in the mirror quite acutely. You're getting criticisms, maybe rejections, and feelings of unacceptance when you enter it. And it could be very dark, and it could be very lonely. And that's the that's the downside of the process of entrepreneurship. And nobody really talks about that. And one of the things that the reason for writing the book as publisher of Success Magazine, I'm really not in the business to just go out and write books, and that's not my business is being right. an author. But I do it to champion what I think is a really important mission right now, and that is to try to turn around the failure rate for small business owners, for entrepreneurship, because statistically, 66% of all those people that finally muster up the courage to break the to break those golden corporate handcuffs and separate from the herd and go into business for themselves, 2/3 of those fail. And, you know, those aren't just statistics. Those are families. Those are people's futures. Those are people's security. And to me, it's unacceptable, and it is a travesty. It needs to be turned around. And when I did, we talked about before we started this call, we commissioned a big white paper report. You know, what are the reasons why most entrepreneurs fail? And then with those reasons, how can we help turn around those statistics and prevent some of this failure and empower them into success? But when we did the research, what I found was startling. I mean, all the previously reported reasons and assumptions for the failure rate, whether it be capital or location or credit or inventory management right. or competition or technology, were wrong. And failure was not really due, for the most part, to outside factors. They were due to internal factors. They weren't economic. They were emotional. And it was the unexpected and terrifying emotional roller coaster and entrepreneur right. experiences. That's the greatest factor to why most quit and ultimately fail. But it doesn't have to be that way if they only knew what was ahead. I'll give you an example. A friend of mine is the CEO of a large company in Salt Lake City, and he's Mormon. We're talking about the trials of entrepreneurship. And he says, you know, it's a lot like when I was 18 and I was going to be sent on mission, and I was going 4,000 miles away. And he says, you know, that was scary for me because I'd never been outside of Salt Lake City. I'd barely been removed from the bosom of my mother. And here I was going to be sent 4,000 miles away to a foreign country. And the elders brought me in. They sat me down and they told me every ugly, nasty, horrible, wretched thing that people might say about our religion, about me being in their country. And he said, thank God they did, because if I'd gotten 4,000 miles away and I'd heard these things for the first time, it would have devastated me. I would right. not known what to have thought, and I would have gone screaming home, probably never to return to the religion or what have you. But instead, when I did get 4,000 miles away and when somebody said those things and I felt feelings and experienced those circumstances, I was able to point at them and say, oh my God, you said it just like they said you'd say it. Isn't that funny? He was emotionally bulletproof. He was prepared. He had been warned. And so now when it happened, it was expected and normal, not something completely out of the blue. And so that's really kind of the main impetus of the book, The Entrepreneur Roller Coaster. It is to warn you and prepare you for the emotional journey that you will take. And then, obviously, important to equip you, because you need some real world skills that are really not taught in school, and they weren't part of your upbringing. Because remember, right. 90% of the population are employees. And the people who are raising children, 90% of them are employees.
Right.
And so you don't really have the conditioning and experience or even reference or witness to what the skill sets are to be an entrepreneur that are unique than what it takes to be successful in a corporate environment. And so that's the other part of the purpose of the book, is to not only warn and prepare and to have you become emotionally fortified, but also equip you with the skills you need: sales, recruiting, leadership, and personal productivity and time management.
You know, it's a great read, and you're so right. I remember thinking about, you and I are about the same age, and I remember I went to an entrepreneurship camp when I graduated high school in 87, like right between my graduation and starting my freshman year in college. There's an entrepreneurship camp at the college I went to. And, you know, they had a lot of great local entrepreneurs here. The guy that started Residence Inn and Rent-A-Center and Pizza Hut and all these people were there. And I remember thinking about, you're right. And it's almost like we're looking at the failure rate of entrepreneurs. And it was almost like a given, like, hey, look, you know, 70% of you are going to fail. And you didn't really talk about the why. It was always about business and economics, like you said. You're right. The emotional piece of it, the kind of preparing yourself to slay the dragon every day, the internal dragon, is what I really find so refreshing about what you're doing. So that's exciting to me.
Yeah.
I love what you said in when the first chapter is like, work is going to suck 95% of the time, but the other 5% is what's freaking awesome. And it's so true. You know, I think a lot of times when you go through these kind of entrepreneur journeys, you're thinking, oh, I'm going to do this. And of course, you've got the dreams or the visions of success, but it's a truth that 95% of it really does kind of suck, right?
Yeah, I'll tell you right now, I'm in a Marriott hotel room in Dallas, Texas. Now, I live in both South Beach and San Diego, Miami, and my wife is in South Beach right now, and I'm hauled up in a hotel room here. You know, I came from Vegas where I was doing an event. I forgot to pack another pair of pants, so I had to run to the mall yesterday. I ate by myself last night. I ate breakfast by myself this morning. I'm having to crank out a bunch of projects that I'm really not that interested in, but it's part of the process of what I need to do and to get done. It's part of my business. I go from here to another plane and train and automobile and hotel room hauled up somewhere else. You know, most people don't understand this. They look at like a Bono and his life, and you know, standing on stage, rocking it out to tens of thousands of people, or Oprah on a TV set, you know, interviewing the Dalai Lama, or Richard Branson, you know, doing a PR stunt with a naked model on his back. But they don't see the 95% of Bono laying on a couch on a tour bus, you know, eating at a diner in the middle of the morning, and sitting backstage in a cold, dark, dismal backstage for 3 hours, and Oprah having to go through arduous meetings with attorneys and to take meetings with people, and you know, to deal with HR issues, and Richard Branson and all the liability and the number of times he's named in a lawsuit that he had nothing to do with. And just the reality is that that 5%, when I'm on stage or Bono's on stage or Branson is pulling off another, that is awesome. And it makes all the other 95% worth it. But you've got to know that 95% exists, and you're not going to be blissfully, passionately engaged in your business
every moment, right,
loving
right.
it all the time. That's the myth that's propagated in our society. You got to love what you do. You got to be passionate for it. Well, the only reason why you need to actually kind of love what you do is so that you can drag your sorry ass
through the 95%. That's right.
That's going to suck. And it will suck.
Yeah.
and you just have to grind it out. It's kind of like I walk into the gym a few months back, and I swipe my card, and I'm walking away, and the attendant at the front desk says, "Have fun." And I turned to her and I said, "What?" "Well, have fun." I said, "You think I come here for fun? I freaking hate this place. Yeah. I hate every minute I walk through the threshold of the front door till the minute I walk out the door. I hate this place." She says, "Well, why do you come here?" I said, "I come here for discipline."
You're right.
"Not for fun. I come here for the outcome, not for the journey and not for the process." So, you know, Muhammad Ali had a great quote that I think about often. He said, "I hated every early morning workout I ever had, but I loved being world champion."
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think that they have to love every aspect of what it is they're doing, or there's something wrong. That is just not the way it is. You will have to grind it out through a lot of arduous, mundane, unsexy, uninteresting parts to get to that 5% that in itself is glorious. It's magnificent. It's what life was meant to be like. Steve Wynn is just an extraordinary achiever. Love the guy's story and his whole passion and spirit. And he says, look, as an entrepreneur, there will be dark days. In fact, more dark days than there will be good days.
Right.
But the good days are really friggin' good.
Right. Right. But isn't that I'm coming to find out that's really – in all aspects of life, right? I mean, it's not a playground. It is a battleground. And I think if you can become comfortable with the fact that it's a battleground and learn to enjoy it, it means the 95% is going to suck, but that 5%, if you're going with it with intention, with purpose, and kind of tapped into what you're supposed to do on this planet, then that 5% can be magical, right?
Yeah, yeah. I always ask audiences, you know, what is common between what's similar between people who are unsuccessful and people who are successful? And the answer is that they both hate to do what it takes to be successful.
Right.
But successful people just do it anyway. And I think it's actually refreshing for unsuccessful people to realize that successful people hate this crap too.
Right.
It's like I had a friend of mine that became a vegetarian, and another friend of mine says, "Oh, well, it's easier for you. You love vegetables." And he's like, "No, I don't."
Right.
Just like being healthy. And it was actually kind of an epiphany for the guy who was asking the question. It's like, "Oh, well, you don't like it, but you're deciding to do it anyway." "Yeah, because it's good for me." It's like, so you don't have to like it, but you still have to do it. And when you do, my mentor Jim Rohn would say, you know, in life, you will suffer one of two pains, which right there already tells you something great about life. You will suffer. And he says, but you get to choose your suffering, the pain of discipline or the pain of regret. And the pain of discipline weighs ounces, and the pain of regret weighs tons. And so if you're willing to just trade in the pain of discipline, doing the things you might not want to do so that you can get the things that you really want to get, then life becomes a little bit more, I guess, understandable about the pathway to getting to the other side.
Yeah, and it's true. You said the word epiphany there. I mean, even early on when I started having these conversations, I'm sure you've experienced this with all the successful people that you've, interviewed and you've sat down with. I'm sure you've learned so much just from doing that. I know I have from doing this show. And I remember asking early on Steve Forbes, and I asked him, I said, "Well, at what point did you stop becoming afraid?" And he laughed and he says, "I wake up every morning, feeling like I'm not supposed to be in this space, or some resistance telling him he doesn't belong in this space, but he works through it anyway. And then something profound always happens on the other side."
Yeah, I have found that to be the same answer when I've asked that of people who think they are courageous and you ask Richard Branson, even a Steve Jobs, these people that look so brazen and so courageous all the time, and they all feel exactly as you just stated. And people ask me all the time, how did you start out as an entrepreneur? And I say, well, I started out as every entrepreneur starts out. I started out afraid, nervous, without a clue what to do or even what to expect as an entrepreneur. I had no prior experience, no training, no guidance. And so I mostly did it wrong. Got lots of skinned knees, lots of bloody noses and bruises on my pride and ego, but it's also how I kind of figured out how to do it right, right? You know, my life personally has been a living laboratory over the last several decades of trial, error, failure, and some success mixed in there, which is, you know, why I also wrote the book, to try to help save would-be entrepreneurs and veteran entrepreneurs lots of those unnecessary headaches and heartaches and wallet aches, and help try to significantly accelerate their success by trying to help them do it right the first time. But it really is the origin of every great success story you've ever read about. It all started out in fear, nervousness, and without a clue.
Yeah, your book talks about, you know, 6 brain hacks to conquer fear. I love those. You want to talk about some of those? I mean, I love number 3, particularly the 20 seconds of courage, and how you say courage is overrated. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, fear is part, it's built into our DNA structure for the last 200,000 years. It was used to keep, the reason why we've survived as a species is we have these great fear survival response mechanisms built into our nervous system. But that was built in at a time over hundreds of thousands of years when there was real threats walking around our neighborhoods, right? You know, by a potential warring tribe or a panther laying in the weeds, or, you know, a lion, or you know, all these threats that we had to be on constant alert and have immediate response reactions. Well, the problem is that we'll have all of those embedded fear mechanisms built into our system, but we're walking around in a modern society without the same threat levels.
Right.
So we're transposing them onto things that are inane, like we're afraid of the phone. Like we're literally we have the nervous system response fear mechanism to the phone as we would to an approaching attacking lion, right? Or we're afraid of a microphone and standing in front of a room full of people as if it's a warring tribe that's about to rape and pillage your village or something. And, you know,
right.
it's inane. Or going over and introducing yourself to a stranger. You know, you just, people become debilitated with fear. You're like as if you're going to walk over to a man-eating gorilla. I mean, it's so we're the look. I'm in front of a computer here that seems to have an iOS update. You know, every third Tuesday, and yet as a operating system, as a species, we haven't had an iOS update in 200,000 years. Right. We're operating on some really old software, right?
Right.
So the reality is that You can't fix that. You can't, you know, uproot your natural normal fear response systems. But what you can do is hack it. And the one you're referring to, which is 20 seconds of courage, is that you know, courage is not the absence of fear. It is feeling the fear and doing it anyway, stepping
right
into it. And you don't have to live courageously. In fact, you can live 99.98% of the time as an absolute coward.
Right.
if you just know the few things that you need to do to progress on your goals, and it could be making prospecting calls, it could be introducing yourself to a stranger, it could be walking up to the front of the room and start speaking in front of a small group, whatever it is that is the block to you achieving your great goal, that because you have some fear based on it. And just first off, no, fear's okay. Fear's normal. You're a human being. You're going to experience fear. If you feel fear, that does not make you inferior. It makes you a human.
Right. That's right.
Normal. Okay. So instead, feel the fear, and it only takes 20 seconds. The great thing about the brain is that as soon as it realizes that it's not under this transposed threat danger, it will calm down. A great example of that is Seymour Epstein of the University of Massachusetts took some novice skydivers up in a plane, and as you know, put heart monitors on them, and as expected, as the plane went up higher and higher and higher, their heart rate went higher and higher and higher as their nervousness and fear grew and grew and grew. And then when they were pushed out the door of the plane and they were plummeting to the earth, within a matter of 10 to 20 seconds, their heart rate dropped precipitously. And they started to actually experience joy. Once they realized that they were under the safety of the canopy of the parachute, their heart rate dropped precipitously. So they didn't actually fear the activity. They feared the anticipation of the activity.
Right.
And that's the reality of a phone call and a standing in front of a microphone or introducing yourself to a stranger. You're actually not afraid of the activity because the activity is – there's nothing to be afraid of. But your anticipation of the fear of that activity is what grips us, which is the reason why the great quote, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, because the fear of the fear is what actually is what stops us.
Yep.
So in 20 seconds, you can say, okay, I'm afraid to introduce myself to that person. In 20 seconds, if you just shut your brain down, walk over to that person, stick your hand out and say, hi, my name is, I've always wanted to meet you, and shake that person's hand. As soon as you start engaging in the conversation with that person and your brain realizes, oh, hey, this person is not going to eat us.
Right, right.
your heart rate drops, or you're afraid to make that phone call. You know, you're not sure what they're going to say. Are you going to feel rejected, unaccepted? Is this going to be the end of your career? Blah, blah, blah. Shut your brain off. Pick up the phone. Punch the numbers. And then say, hi, I'm calling the follow-up, blah, 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 blah. And it only takes 20 seconds to complete, to engage. And then once you're engaged, the brain goes, oh, we're not going to die. And fear is dissipated. So take the things that are more important, are most important for you to do to achieve your goals. And if you are just courageous for 20 seconds, three times a day, imagine if you did every day three things that you're afraid of, day after day upon day after day, how much you would break through. Because people spend their whole days trying to avoid one instance of fear. And if you actually stepped into the thing that you fear three times, and again, we're talking about a totality of a minute.
Minute, yeah.
It would boggle your mind how much progress you could make in your life. Because and I'll finish with this: the only thing that stops people from reaching their true potential, because people are not living up to their potential. Their current results, and even if they are successful, if we're truthful for them with themselves, is only a fraction of what they're truly capable of, what they were bestowed in terms of capabilities and gifts by their creator versus what they're utilizing and their current results is embarrassing, and it's only a fraction. And the only thing that stops them from realizing that potential is fear.
Yep.
That's it. And so if you can find a way to hack your brain, and this is one of those ways, so that you just turn it off for 20 seconds, step into it, and you do that three times a day, day after day, it's unbelievable what you can accomplish and how much you'll separate yourself from your contemporaries and those that are in your quote-unquote competitive landscape.
Yeah, I love that. You know, it's so true. When you break it down to that perspective, it's just, look, we're doing it three times a day. That's a minute. And so many profound things could happen. You know, I do believe that if it's making your gut tight, your throat tighten up, whatever, that's a barometer of probably what you should be doing. And if you can, just like you said, 20 seconds, work through it, something profound is going to happen the other side. That's what's so exciting about it. Yeah, I love that. How did it start for you? You know, I love you give a little sense of the beginnings. You know, you grew up, essentially your dad raised you by himself. Your dad was kind of a hard ass from what I read and understand. And what kind of gave you the entrepreneurial spirit?
Well, yeah, I was raised by a single father who was a university football coach. And, you know, my dad parented like he coached football. You know?
right.
No whining, no crying, no excuses, lots of yelling, lots of cursing, and that instilled in me a discipline. You know, the way you got love and attention in my household was to achieve, and it made me ambitious, it made me goal oriented, and it made me want to achieve in order to get love and appreciation from my father. And so those things are very positive things. And, you know, he made me believe that I could beat anybody at anything if I just outwork and outlast and stay consistent. And it didn't matter somebody's skill, experience, talent, background, what have you. And so those were really good formative principles. And the thing I have to credit entrepreneurship to was my dad's mentor, who was his college football coach, because my grandfather was an employee for 47 years, loyal and he worked at a creamery, Berkeley Farms in the Bay Area, and retired on a pension that he could barely afford to live off of. And my dad, you know, saw his dad be an employee, and so his dad, he was going to be an employee. He's going to be a football coach or and a professor, and you know, he's going to take a wage like his father did. That's all he knew. But my dad's mentor got into real estate and kept asking my dad to join him in real estate. My dad at that point had three kids and a runaway freight train for a wife financially, and couldn't afford to just sort of jump off and do this. And so he told him no, but my dad's mentor was a very charismatic, persistent, relentless guy. And my dad finally said, I'll try it on the, you know, weekends. I'll help you with open houses. And that became sometimes also the weekends and nights. And then my dad started earning more money part-time than he was earning full-time. And that gave him the comfort to kind of transition into real estate full-time. So instead of me watching my father be an employee as I grew up, I got the chance to watch my father be an entrepreneur as I grew up. So the only thing I wanted to ever be was an entrepreneur. The idea of being an employee at that point didn't seem to be sensible at all. But it would have been reversed if my dad's mentor hadn't set the example. And so he really changed the trajectory of our family forever because he pushed and prodded my dad into entrepreneurship.
You saw that transformation of your father. Well, that's a gift. That's really cool that you saw that.
And so it's one of the other reasons why I've committed so much to this mission of trying to onboard 10 million new entrepreneurs over the next 3 years who succeed. Because Les Davis was my dad's mentor, changed our family's future forever, changed my life. I would not have the life I have today if it hadn't been for Les Davis prodding my father and changing my father's path and that being my reference point for what was possible for me. And so I know the power of a mentor, of somebody that push and prods and helps and guides and gets someone started along this you know, difficult as well as scary journey. And to think that, man, you know, if I just take some of the skills, gifts, and experience that I've got and help empower, let alone one, but maybe 10 million new entrepreneurs, think about the trajectory of lives and families that are forever changed because of that. So that's how it all sort of began for me.
You know, and there's no better time, really. I mean, you're more tapped into this than me. I consider myself a newbie to the entrepreneurship front. And every day I'm finding out more and more things. But I do feel, despite the negativity, it seems things are teetering out of control. But on the other hand, it does seem like there's more opportunities than ever for somebody to be an entrepreneur or kind of define their own destiny, more so than 50 years ago. I mean, for sure. Even 20 years ago.
More so than 5 years ago.
Yeah.
10 years ago. I mean, no, there's never been a better time to be an entrepreneur in the history of humanity than right now, and maybe never again too, because we're experiencing this massive shift between the industrial age that's crumbled down and the digital age and empowerment that creates, where a few used to own control. They had control of access. They had control of access to the marketplace, the shelf space, the distribution channels. They had access to the advertising marketplace. They had access to talent. They had access to capital. And it was exclusive to the few at the top of the ivory towers. Technology has obliterated all those access points. And now we have access to a global marketplace at our fingertips, access to crowdsourcing funding and talent accessible virtually from all over the world. I mean, the game has – there's been a tectonic plate shift that is – it will look back in history as this was the transitional moment that really was the new burgeoning frontier for entrepreneurship. And I'll just give you a very direct example. I started a company in 1999-2000, and I raised over $3.5 million to build that company. And today, I could start that same company on the same technology with the same platform that we built for $5,000 to $10,000.
Wow!
This is the difference between today and 2000.
Wow!
And so it's everything is more accessible. And everything is far more financially efficient as well. And the other thing is that because of that, so say somebody's got a job right now, they literally could start something on the side with very little money. And because of access to the marketplace through digital advertising as well as through social media community building mechanisms, they can test that model and prove that it works as well as prove that it scales on the side for very little part-time. Those kind of initiatives, that you couldn't do that part-time. You couldn't do that with very little funding. Even like 5 to 8 years ago,
yeah,
it wasn't as accessible as it is right now. And so these are, I mean, the most glorious times ever to step into entrepreneurship. And we will always see the progression of technology and things getting faster and more efficient. But this changeover basically kind of takes the monopoly board and wipes it clean.
Yeah.
And now everybody's got a chance to reclaim Park Place and Broadway and all the rest of those, because these new the new dynamics of the marketplace are just beginning to form.
Yeah, it is exciting. It's truly exciting. And I don't think if I hadn't pursued the entrepreneurial path, I wouldn't have seen it as clearly. And for sure, because I there's so many people that are making dents in the universe that you never hear about, the mass people don't hear about. And there's so many people making tremendous strides and huge dents, like I said, in the universe. Well, that's exciting. And it's refreshing to hear that from you. I mean, what excites you the most about, say, the next 20 years?
Well, what excites me the most is what we just talked about, the ability to empower and onboard new entrepreneurs who succeed, right? That's the caveat, who succeed. There's plenty. A bit of my fear is that we do have millions of people moving into entrepreneurship by either inspiration, because here's the other deal. When I started out as an entrepreneur, it wasn't cool to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, if you're an entrepreneur, that basically told that was a statement to society that you weren't smart enough to get into the good schools and you weren't talented enough to get a good job.
Right.
And so you became an entrepreneur, quote unquote, because you couldn't do it the societally accepted way. So you were counter culture and so forth. But with the Zuckerbergs, the Airbnbs, the Ubers, the Silicon Valley stories, it has become cool. And this is people don't realize this. This is a recent phenomenon. The last 5 to 8 years has entrepreneurship has been rebranded to be somewhat cool. The millennial market sort of
the lifestyle
maturing,
yeah.
Maturing has made that a much cooler thing to be. So by inspiration, we've got millions of people pouring into entrepreneurship. Also by desperation, because a lot of those jobs that went away during the recession, they're not coming back because companies have figured out how to do more with less. They've outsourced. They've created efficiencies. And we are seeing a reversion. This country started as an entrepreneurial country. I mean, every guy that signed the Declaration of Independence was an entrepreneur. They had their own farms, trades, or businesses, or law practices. They were all entrepreneurs. 90% of the population at the point were self-employed by some source. But yet the industrial age came and it reversed it 100%. Well, now with the deconstruction of that and technology making access points available to everybody, we're seeing an exact reversion to where there will be more independent contractor and self-employment and entrepreneurship. So by desperation, because those jobs aren't there. So we've got millions and millions of people moving into entrepreneurship, but they are not ready. They are not prepared. They are not equipped. They don't have any idea what they're about to experience and the skills that they're going to need to succeed at it. And so we already have a 2/3 failure rate, but then we've got millions of those that are novice, like they didn't even choose the courage to, so to speak, in a counterculture to step out of the herd to move into this environment, which kind of put them in a different position of preparedness. But now we've got people just running into it and the failure rate could skyrocket. So what has me fired up and has me passionate is to try to equip, try to prepare, and try to help all these people who seek this which I encourage as their pathway to the future of taking self-responsibility for their destiny and for their financial future in entrepreneurship, but help them succeed and prevent some of those mistakes that could cause failure and heartache.
Well, I appreciate you doing this. I mean, you know, as I still consider myself a newbie entrepreneur, and every day I'm just constantly pushing forward and surrounding myself with like-minded folks and listening and learning from folks like you. And it is encouraging. It's refreshing for you to speak the truth that you do in all the work that you do. And for that, personally, I thank you for what you're doing. You know, I find myself, particularly over the last 3 years, and I've moved less away from it, but I find myself trying to emulate or at least kind of follow the easy trap of kind of falling into someone else's dreams or comparing myself. That's the comparison trap is what I find myself falling into all the time, where it's like, wow, you know, this guy's successful and I'm not, I must really suck. You know, those type of things come into my mind. What are your thoughts on that?
What people do is they compare people's front of stage with their back of stage reality. So when we see most people's stories, we see their polished press release. We see the outcome of their great success story. But what we don't see is the brutal backstage part of their either life or of the path that they took to get there. So don't emulate somebody's success. Emulate somebody's journey.
Yeah.
And that journey of trial, error, failure, headache, heartache, overcoming doubt, getting up off their rump and going at it again. You know, emulate the journey, not the destination, the outcome. And when you – and it's like I did a lecture on this thing in particular, which is, you know, you want to – model the process, not model the outcome, because you can't model the outcome. You can't model the outcome of a Richard Branson or a Howard Schultz of Starbucks or a Jeff Bezos of Amazon, but you can emulate their process. And their process was tough. I mean, you know, Howard Schultz came from government subsidized housing projects in Brooklyn. You know, Jeff Bezos left a very high paid, high, glamorous Wall Street hedge fund job to take on this very risky newbie idea. And Jeff Bezos has had a numerous number of failures. What people don't realize is the number of times that Jeff Bezos and Amazon have failed and iterated. I mean, Jeff Bezos is personally responsible for $1 billion in failed experiments, and that's what he calls them, experiments. And he says, look, you know, you're going to have to experiment. You're going to have to try lots of things, and most of them are not going to work. And the one or two that work are going to pay for all the failed experiments, but the only way in which to flex your progress is to experiment faster, which means that you're going to have an accumulated number of failures. But you're also going to end up getting to figuring out which ones are going to succeed. And he says, as long as you can survive the time duration you've got through the failures to figure out the ones that are going to succeed, that's the only thing you've got to govern, is to be sure that you can live to fight another day.
Yeah, right.
You know, or what Branson says is like, you know, don't bet the house. Don't let a decision or a bet you're making that if you're wrong, have you living in your car.
Yeah, right.
You know, protect the downside.
Yeah.
And so if you really study their true journey, their path to getting to the success that you like and are tantalized by, and most of that is an emotional journey that they went through. You know, that's what to emulate. Don't emulate, you know, emulate their backstage process, not their front of stage persona today.
Right. Well, and it has to be tapped into your purpose and what's authentically you. You know what I mean? Instead of kind of chasing the influencers and trying to emulate exactly what they do, find what your true voice is, or find what your true purposes or what you put on. And I think it is that whole series of trial and error and fail and try and repeat, you know, repeat that process. One of my favorite parts of the book, you mentioned your father's mentor that he called coach, you guys called coach. But when you went and saw him that last time, And he gave you that, you know, don't miss the point. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. So my dad's mentor was, he came from Arkansas, one of nine, grew up poor, abject poverty. And he was a tough country guy. He succeeded at a brute force, and to him, life was a hand-to-hand combat battle. And your score sheet was your bank account. And he accumulated, I think, I don't remember the number, it was either 400 or 900 units of real estate, and amassed a big pile of cash. And you know, he was very successful financially. And he ended up getting cancer, and I was in the Bay Area, and my dad was going to go see him, and he asked me to drive up to where he was to pay a visit, and we did. And it ended up being, I guess, a week or so before he ended up passing away. But we went up there, and he had a hospital bed in his room, and we just sort of reflected on old stories and, you know, the glory days, and funny, and laughed and talked and so forth. And we finished up after about an hour. We're headed out the door, and I was following my dad to the car. And just as I was about to approach the front door, I hear this, "Darren, Darren." And it was Les Davis. And he was calling me back to the room, and I thought there was something wrong. So I kind of rushed in there, and I put my hand on the hospital bed rails, and I leaned over and I said, "Les, are you okay?" And it was the first time he pulled his head up off the pillow the whole day. And he grabbed my forearm, and he pulled himself up, and he looked me sternly in the eye, like only Les Davis could do, with these just intense eyes. And it's the most life I had seen in him the whole visit. And he got close to me, and he said, "Don't miss the point." And he squeezed my arm, and I said, what do you mean, Les?" And he collapsed back in his bed, and he said, "You know, I thought that the aim of life was to succeed and to, you know, accumulate wealth." And he said, "I wish I'd spent as much time accumulating relationships as I had houses. And I wish I'd made deposits emotionally into the people that I loved and cared for as much as I made deposits into the bank account." And he said, "In the end, don't miss the point." And he made me promise, and I said, "Yeah, Coach, I hear you." And, you know, I really, at the moment, I was just kind of startled and didn't really know what to think, just sort of took it in without really processing it. But it haunted me still to this day, as I tell you this story. Because he was right. I mean, I saw this guy and admired and revered him as an achiever and all the rest of this. And here he was on his deathbed, come to find out. And in the end, he missed the whole point. Like, he focused on the wrong thing his whole life, and it was too late. And he didn't want me to miss that same point. And so whenever I feel like, you know, my mentor Jim Rohn would say, be careful what you give up in the pursuit of what it is that you think you want, because you might be giving up the thing you most wanted. And so whenever I feel like I might be, my ambition might be sort of driving me out of my life, out of the things that I've decided are most important, truly, to not let my ambition get the best of me and over obligate me, so that then I'm burdened to not be able to have the same either capacity or presence or time available to the things that I have stated are most important to me in life. And so to keep the point center.
Yeah, well, that's powerful. As we wrap up here, kind of segue into that, I always like to ask people, you know, who their heroes were. And if you had the opportunity to have this night where you could invite five people, live or dead, to have this awesome dinner conversation, just a night, whole night of conversation with people that you just so greatly admire right now, who would they be?
Well, first was my father. You know, he took me on as a single father at 23 years of age, and we grew up together. And you know, he was tough, but he, you know, he took care of responsibilities and was embedded in me a lot of things that make me who I am, no doubt. Second is my mentor, Jim Rohn, probably the second most influential man in my life, his influence is indelible and kind of took me from the discipline upbringing my father gave me, and Jim sort of helped me craft my philosophy and my character and the attributes that were most important to being an influential leader and communicator and so forth. And so Jim would be the other. Another would be Les Davis. He did have through my father a great influence. And another would be Ayn Rand.
I
discovered her work, you know, in a very pivotal place in the sort of growth of. It was one of the first times that I realized, oh my God, somebody else thinks like this.
Right, you know, right.
I felt validated for that. Yeah. I thought I was weirdo and a nut job, and I felt sort of that. I was the oddball. I was like, "Oh man, no! This is so validating that
yes,
yeah, maybe this is maybe I'm not weird that other people think like this." So that would be my group, and then you know, there's always the other characters of history who you would admire. You know, be it the Lincolns of the yesteryear and so forth.
I love you're the first one that said Ayn Rand, and that would be great. I'd love to sit down with her too. That's a good that's a good list, and I love the fact that it's so personal. I love it when guests. Make it so personal, having the father, Jim, your mentor, Jim Rohn and Les Davis. Yeah. Thank you for that. My gosh, it's been, you know, almost 45 minutes we've been talking and I could talk to you for another hour or so. I love what you do, Darren. Congratulations on the new book. You got some other resources you want to share with our listeners. How can people reach out to you and talk about the white paper? Again, here's your chance to let us know how we can connect with you more.
Yeah, so we'll make the white paper available to your audience to be able to download for free. And so not only do you get the white paper itself, but I walk you through each of the eight mistakes and how to interpret them into your real-world business and make sure that you avoid those mistakes. So you just go to 8tragicmistakes.com, the number 8tragicmistakes.com. You can download the white paper and then it'll send you the video series that walks you through it, and then one of the other things that that I do it's a nonprofit effort for me. It was part of my give back program, 20-year anniversary of the relationship between when I met my mentor Jim Rohn, and it's where it's called Darren Daily, and I send you one idea to just sort of jumpstart your day every morning. It's under 5 minutes, something that you can read, watch, or listen to. And it's just one little sort of aha trigger just to sort of set the mindset for the day. Have it while you're, you know, watch it or listen to it or read it while you're having coffee or your smoothie or your tea in the morning. And it kind of just sort of gets your day started. And that's totally free. DarrenDaily.com.
Darren, awesome stuff. I'll have links to all this on the post when it's available. I appreciate you coming on the show. Thanks for taking the time and your busy schedule to share this with my audience. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard. I enjoyed it.
Richard invites you to become a part of the Dose of Leadership community. Visit doseofleadership.com and sign up to receive his free Common Sense Leadership ebook, a guide that highlights how all of us can learn to become calm, confident, consistent, and courageous in all aspects of our lives. Richard is also available as a speaker for your next event. Richard specializes in practical leadership and change management. He has a philosophy of inspiring everyone to think and act like a leader, which is based on timeless natural principles and common sense. You can get more info by visiting doseofleadership.com.